My name is Pete Steinke. The title of this section is The Search for the Real Self. Being a pastor before I am a therapist, I need to have a text for my presentation. And the text for this afternoon comes from The Velveteen Rabbit. "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "When you are real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once, like being wound up?" he asked, "or bit by bit?" "It doesn't happen all at once," said the skin horse. "You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily, or have sharp edges, or have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off, and your eyes drop out, and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand." This is our text. The title for this section actually comes from a book by a man named Jim Masterson, The Search for a Real Self. Masterson is one of a number of new theorists called object relation theorist or self-psychology theorist. They differ from the old Freudian school in several respects. Freud believed that the objects in the world existed for the gratification or the satisfaction of the drives or the impulses of the individual. It was for this reason that Freud wrote his book, Civilization and Its Discontent, because he knew that our drives and impulses and instincts would not always nor completely or perfectly be satisfied and gratified. Therefore, there would always be discontent. Also, at the heart of Freud's theory was infantile sexuality, and the whole period called the Oedipal period, which involved a triangle, father, mother, and child. The new theorists, however, do not believe that this is the key period in human development. Rather, they see the key period as that period called separation individuation. And in a few minutes, I will explain to you this schema that you see on the board here about human development. Secondly, the new theorist or self-psychologist do not emphasize the role of father as now they emphasize the role of mother and see that the key is not father, mother, child, but the dyad of mother and child. They also believe that the objects out there in the world that an infant begins to discover are not there simply for satisfaction or gratification. The new theorists believe that the primitive need of all human beings is to be recognized and to recognize others. So at the basis of human life is connectedness. Self-psychologists or object relations theorists believe that we are more connected than we are unique. That the objects out there, we seek not just gratification from these objects, we seek, however, attachment with these objects. So take a look for a moment at this board, and I have laid out for you Margaret Mahler's concept of early childhood development and how does the self develop. And I want to talk about that in the beginning in terms of how we're going to look at the search for the real self. With the birth of the child, there is trauma. For all of a sudden, the child is separated from the umbilical cord and from this safe resting place this nice envelope called the womb. And all of a sudden, this wonderful self-sustaining ecosystem has now been interrupted, and the child is thrust into the world. Otto Rank believed that the birth trauma was the greatest anxiety that we would ever experience in life, and we would never get over it, and that we would always suffer from separation anxiety. William James called this experience of birth the big, blooming, buzzing confusion, which we partly resolve but never is resolved throughout our lifetime. But what happens to this child is all of a sudden there is dramatic change. There is change in temperature. There is change in noise level. There is change in light as opposed to darkness. And the child all of a sudden comes as a stranger in a strange land. But what happens is the child does not have the capacity to distinguish itself from mother. This is a period, the period of primary autism, of undifferentiation. There is no outside and no inside. There is no sense of boundaries. In fact, Salvador Minuchin, a family therapist, used a play on words to describe the infant and called the infant the Mo Child. Also coined another word called the chother, that infant and mother are the same. So when a child has hunger and then seeks mother's nipple, that's all part of one experience. There's no capacity in the child to distinguish between its instinct and its satisfaction through the nipple. So this is a world of undifferentiation, complete fusion, complete symbiosis. No ability at this point to differentiate one thing from another. I've used a little play on words too, and I often talk to my colleagues in the ministry who cannot separate themselves from their job, and I call them churtors or clercons. They don't know where they begin and end and the congregation begins and ends. This often happens to be a problem for many of us, especially folks who get into relationships that are very often unhealthy, fused, enmeshed relationships. It's a throwback to this particular period when it was undifferentiated. I think it's rather interesting that in the psychological birth of the child, we have the same kind of scenario that we have in the scripture of the creation of the physical world. In the beginning, there is the tohu wohu. There is the chaos. There is this undifferentiated mass. It is not until God separates the heavens from the earth, the land from the sea, the day from the night, that there is order in creation. In fact, there is not order in creation until Adam develops the capacity for naming. Because the first problem Adam had in Eden was everything was everything. There was nothing. Nothing had names. There were no name tags. Everything was generic. So the first task given to Adam was to name everything. Separate the lion from the horse and the horse from the insect. Name it. Separate it. Set boundaries. Limit it. There is no order in life until there are boundaries. Keep that in mind, because that's going to be important as I go through the rest of these steps. We will always need boundaries, not only in the physical world, but also in the psychological world. We need to learn where I begin and end and where other people begin and end. Okay, through this period of primary autism, where mother and child are a dual unity, the child all of a sudden begins to discover that there's an object out there that is not me. It's kind of interesting that the first thing a child discovers is not a self, but is an object, something that's not me. The child begins to get that understanding through this touch of skin. There is something that rubs up against me. So the whole idea of touching and holding is so important to the psychological birth of an infant, and it's still true for the rest of us later in life, because it's through touch that I get a sense that there is something outside that is not me. I also need to develop a psychological skin, a skin that tells me there is a sense in here that holds together all of my sensations and drives and instincts. So, to rephrase Descartes, I think, therefore I am, I would say I have been touched, therefore I am. Not to be touched is not to live, because it is through touch that I begin to get my first experience of something out there that is not me, an other or an object. Now, some of you may be turned off by the phrase object relations. Really, it's a phrase that means object-subject relations. Of course, the object is a person. We do not become selves until, first of all, we are in relationship with other objects. Now, as the infant begins to discover that there is an object out there that is not me, the child begins to get the first sense of an inside and an outside, a self, a sense of a self, and a sense of an other. What I would say here is, you and I are one, and I'm trying to attach and stay attached to you. So as the child begins to get some sense of differentiation, the need is to stay attached. The great fear of the infant at this time would be to be abandoned. Now, the key period in object relations theory is this period called autonomy and rapprochement. And that's 18 months to 3 years. It is at this point that the child develops two capacities, which enables it to separate from mother. The first capacity is to walk. Just by merely walking, a child begins to get some spatial, physical separation from mother. The second capacity is to talk, to be able to symbolize, and through symbolization, to get some distance between others and myself. We often talk about the terrible twos, which is really a misnomer. It should be called the wonderful twos, because the child is learning to separate itself out from mother. The child is learning to get a sense of self. The child is separating, developing some sense of autonomy. It is at this point that many theorists say the child is like a king. The child feels omnipotent. The child can do anything. The child can put anything it wants in its mouth and still live. The child can stick anything in any socket and still exist. There is this sense the child can do anything. But then, somewhere along the line here, the child becomes a little bit of a coward and wants to reattach to mother, to be refueled, and then to go out again and be separate. What is being described here is what goes on for the rest of your life and my life. How do I remain separate, yet keep in touch? How do I become a self, yet a self that is connected in relation to other people? This is when the child begins to experience the massive ambivalences of life. This is the child's beginning lesson in ambiguity. I need to be a self, yet I also need to stay in touch. Incidentally, it is out of the lack of capacity to do one or the other from which we know comes many disturbances later in life. What often happens here is that the child is not allowed to separate from the mother or the primary caretaker. When the child is not allowed to separate and to explore and to play, what happens then, the child has to perform or exist for the sake of the mother. Whenever the child cannot use the primary caretaker for its needs, but must take care of the mother or the primary caretaker's needs, you are going to have the beginning of what is called the false self. The false self is a concept to describe the person who is not permitted to know, express needs or feelings. But the child must exist to take care of mother's needs. And more than likely, a mother or a primary caretaker who uses a child for her needs has come out of a family where her mother or primary caretakers needed her to take care of their particular needs. It is so important that the child have a primary caretaker at this point who acknowledges that the child has needs and the child has feelings, and that the child can not only have them but express them. When this is not encouraged here and continued throughout the rest of the period, you are going to have what is called the false self. The false self is, I have to exist to take care of you. Let me give an example of a 42-year-old pastor that I have in therapy currently. This pastor grew up in a home whereby his mother and father really did not have much intimacy. Consequently, his mother developed asthma. And whenever his mother did not get what she wanted, she would go into an asthma attack. The father always pretended that his family was wonderful and he was wonderful, was active in church, etc. But the father would often blame his son for his mother, for his wife's asthma attack or the boy's mother's asthma attack. In fact, many times the father would say, look what you're doing to your mother. Someday you're going to kill your mother. Now these are the words that the father is telling the son. So what is his role in this family? His role is to take care of mother so she doesn't get sick. Anytime, though, he became a self and he got into his needs or his feelings, somebody would say, you cannot have them nor express them. Look what you're doing to your mother. When he was 25, his mother died of asthma. What did he think? I killed her. In my head, I know I didn't. But the message was so repeated and reinforced that in here, I feel like I did. Now, he married a woman who he would describe as being a very angry woman. She was abandoned by her father when she was 12 years of age at a very important point of time. They have had what has been called an enmeshed or a fused marital relationship, which means there's not a good sense of separateness, but what one feels affects what the other feels. In enmeshment, and in a later section, by the way, I'm going to talk more about enmeshed relationships, but basically in enmeshment, sameness is closeness. People want you to think, feel, do exactly the way they do. Differences are threatening. So people must always take care of one another. It's the dependent, codependent relationship. It's the blaming, escaping, it's a pursuer distance relationship, and I'll explain those a little bit later, too. But basically, what she would be angry, and she would contain the anger for the relationship. He would feel like a little boy and get guilty, and then try to take care of her. What was he doing? Trying to resolve the unresolved issues with his mother. He always felt that he was the cause of her anger. Finally, one day, he just leaves. The next day, by the way, was a Sunday. He did a very strategic day. Who was going to preach? He left and moved to another town, finally informed his wife where he was, and said, all I know is something's wrong in this relationship. Well, he was a very prominent and popular pastor in the state. Synod publication announced that he had burnout, etc. Nobody knows that he's actually having problems, marital problems. But he knows that he cannot go back into this marriage until he's able to define himself, to set up his boundaries. Because he says, when I get into this relationship, I lose my sense of separateness. I simply get enmeshed with her. He says, I know what my problem is, and I'm not focusing just on her. Unless I can become a self in relationship to her, I don't know if we can have a marital relationship. This is an illustration of how this issue is transported over the decades, even into midlife. We are always struggling with this issue to be a separate self and yet to be in healthy touch with another person. Not to be cut off from them, too separate, or not to be fused with them, meaning having very little separateness at all. Let me describe for you also object constancy. After this particular period of separation and attachment comes a period of object constancy. This is the child has to be able to mentally internalize the primary caretaker. And what is important is that the primary caretaker or this object have a sense of wholeness and constancy. So even if mother leaves, what happens? The child still knows that mother exists because the child has a mental representation. Now, a child at this period where the object is not constant or the object is not conceived as being whole has all kinds of problems later in life. This is usually the person who becomes kind of a Don Juan and goes from bed to bed in search of the object. This is the person who changes jobs every year. This is the person who just have ants in their pants, still looking for an object to hold on to. Okay. Also, it is important in object constancy to recognize that mother is one person. Because the first thing a child does is, at this period, is if mother is good and she gives me the cookies, she's good. But sometimes mother does give me cookies, so therefore she's what? Bad. So you got the witch doll kind of thing. But the good mother and the bad mother are the same mother. Now, some children don't have the capacity to integrate it, to put it together. Mother's either good or mother's either bad. But in object constancy, one has to learn to internalize the maternal object and to integrate that maternal object to see that the mother is one and the same. This, by the way, is the first defensive maneuver that a self uses. It's called splitting. Repression is a later development. Repression is forgetting what you forgot. But you had to have a memory. At this point, memory is not too well advanced. So it's called splitting. The way to defend against life and its all of its inconsistencies and traumas is to split it into black and white, either or, yes or no. So that kind of black and white thinking is very primitive. It is the most basic form of defensive maneuver that one has. Okay, let me just stop here for a moment to see if there's some questions or comments before I go to the next material. Anyone? Freud believed that the key thing was the Oedipus thing, getting mother all for myself and getting father out of the picture, and the idea of killing him off, okay? And then also talked about infantile sexuality. By the way, it's kind of interesting that now some people are thinking that the Freudian idea of infantile sexuality, which developed out of his contact with these hysterical women in Vienna, the point was that they weren't fantasizing what happened. These were more than likely women who had been sexually abused. And Freud didn't recognize it. Just didn't recognize it. And saying that now the emphasis is not way back here, 4 to 5, 6, and father and Oedipus issues. It is now here in this autonomy rapprochement of separating and reapproaching, reattaching is the key to human development. The need to be separate yet to be one. Now, one of the criticisms of Margaret Mahler, and I would join in that, is that the idea is you're only healthy if you become totally autonomous and you grow away from relationship. I don't believe that. I believe the key is that you begin to differentiate yourself more while in relationship. See, and I think the other favors the masculine sense of separation as opposed to the feminine sense of relationship. And I think the truer sense is male and female need both a sense of separateness and closeness. And so I always get my separateness, but always in relationship to somebody. Does that help you in any?
Okay. Do you have a relationship where you're not separate? You just said that enmeshed marriage isn't very good.
You can have a situation where two people are distancers. He lives in New York, she lives in Los Angeles, and they have distance from each other. Or they may live in the same house in Oshkosh, but don't talk to one another.
But I mean, can you have a relationship without a sense of self?
Oh, a sense of self. No. Well, you can. But what's going to happen here is if you have a very enmeshed relationship, you're going to have high reactivity to one another. And lower forms of existence, and this is even saying lower levels of differentiation in human beings, there's more reactivity. Oh, yeah, what thinks you're so great? Well, what do you mean I'm so great? What about you? Have you ever looked at, and all of the, on. We all might think you're low level. We all get to some point there, my folks. But that's what I'm talking about. It's very highly reactive. There's very little thought. I don't want to go into that too much because that's going to steal thunder from another presentation. But yes, unless there's a nice sense of self, there will not be a good sense of closeness. Because this is the paradox. The better your sense of boundaries are, you choose to let them down and get close. After getting close, you can withdraw from the other and what? Put your boundaries back up. If you have poor sense of boundaries, you get close, but you get like this. You get stuck together and you can't get apart. And you get very emotional reactive to one another. And that's enmeshment. And that goes back to a lot of unresolved stuff right back here in primary autism. So it's true. You cannot have good intimacy, good closeness, unless there's some sense of self in each person. And really, I would say that the more you encourage each other to be selves, the more you're going to encourage your own closeness. That's the paradox. If you become too separate, you can see what happens. You're just too afraid to get close. And you never let your boundaries down or only at particular periods or times. Yes. There was another hint. Yes.
Are you going to be talking a little bit about how people can develop this sense of self if they come from this kind of a dysfunctional background?
Yes, I will talk about. I will not talk about that so much today, the birth of the self in adulthood, but I am going to talk about that because I spent a lot of my time doing that. How does this self get birthed in adulthood when there has been this problem back here? Okay? See, when you're at this stage here of autonomy and you are permitted to have your own feelings and to have your own needs, you're in touch with your own real self. This is who I am. I do not live for you or for anybody else. But when you're not allowed to be a real self, you then have to take care of mother's needs or somebody's primary caretaker's need, and you become a false self. You're always taking care of them. What kind of impression am I making? How am I taking care of you? And two of the major personality disorders, because of the false self, happens to be the narcissistic or the borderline. The narcissistic has an inflated self-image. The borderline has a deflated self-image. So in response to the deflated self-image, the borderline tends to cling and clutch and be fusey. If I could use a little word there. If you saw the film Fatal Attraction, the female in that film is a borderline personality. And her need to clutch, to cling. I need you to exist. I cannot exist as a separate self. So this young lawyer and this gal have an affair. For him it was fun and kicks and he leaves. For her it was serious business, deadly serious business. Because in the end of the movie, once he separated from her, she was going to destroy him, kill him. Okay. There's this need. I don't exist, and I'm not a person without you. You know, it's like, I can't live without you. You listen to a lot of the adolescent music. A lot of it is pathological. But you see, adolescent love is really fusion. It's romance. You know, you don't know where one begins and the other ends. They're all tied up together. And then they go home and are on their phone for 3 hours. I mean, they just can't have separateness. It's just, but that's the beginning stage. You had your hand up.
You answered it when you started talking about borderline.
Okay. In another session, correct. Right. I'm interested in borderline personality disorders because I find a lot of clergy who have those characteristics. And since I work with clergy, a lot of clergy who are pleasers, a lot of clergy who will not take stands, a lot of clergy who get their own identity mixed up with the congregation, I see a lot of borderline characteristics, so I'm very interested in how you deal with that disorder. Now, the narcissist, on the other hand, who has this inflated sense of self, see, the inner self is so sick or empty that I have to cover it up. So I always project images outside. It comes out of some kind of injury out of childhood or somewhere where one always had to exist for mother's sake. And therefore, the narcissist, if he gets or she gets in touch with shame, will strike out. I'll give you an example. We had a Lutheran clergy was installed in a congregation and 2 weeks later murdered his wife. The particular person, when I went out to these congregations to work with them after this event, it was interesting. They all said to me, you know, we felt like we really knew this man. But then they start thinking, you know, he told us everything we ever wanted to hear. He knew how to be impressive, to be charming, to be self-confident. He knew how to project images. And everybody felt safe and secure. But his wife knew that he was abusing her. And she was going to expose him and leave. He took one of these cellophane bags, put it over her head, pretended it had been suicide on her part, and murdered her. My hunch is that he got in touch with shame when she threatened to expose him. If she had just left and said nothing, I think she would be living today. But I think he then went into a rage, narcissistic rage. A narcissist, whenever a narcissist goes into a rage, he or she will either destroy someone else or destroys oneself. I have a hunch that some adolescent suicides, you know, to be honest with you, shits don't commit suicide. It's the good kids. And I have a hunch that for some, it's unresolved narcissism. And for some, they're afraid of being exposed, that they're not good enough, even though they're very excellent. And therefore, when they do get in touch with some shame, it's annihilation. They destroy themselves. They take it on themselves. I think this may also happen with some adults, but more with adolescents. That's my own theory. So those are two of the disorders of the false self. It's to cover up feelings. It's to cover up needs. And of course, there are other disorders like the obsessive compulsive. These are also people who will not get in touch with their own needs. There is a book I want to recommend to you if you're interested in this subject. And it's a book by Alice Miller called... The Drama of the Gifted Child. Has anybody read that or aware of it? Okay. It's an excellent book because she doesn't talk about the borderline and the narcissist. She talks about grandiosity and depression, which are really the same terms describing what I described to you. But she has a section in there that I really like, and I want to read it to you. She said, you know, when a child learns that it's okay to have his or her needs or feelings, this is what a child can say. I can be sad or happy whenever anything makes me sad or happy. I don't have to look cheerful for someone else, and I don't have to suppress my distress or anxiety to fit other people's needs. I can be angry, and get this, and no one will die. I can be angry, and no one will get a headache. I can rage and smash things without losing my parents. You see, what was happening back there in early childhood was, if you expressed your feelings and needs and your parents became dissatisfied, you couldn't have your feelings or your needs. So where did they go? They were hidden. But this is wonderful. When people give you permission to have your own feelings and needs, to be a real self. Now, all of us in some way have a false self. All of us in some way have to lessen that part of ourselves and to honor our own feelings and needs and to set up our own boundaries and to differentiate ourselves from others and to feel good about who we are. I don't know why it is, but in the Christian church there's too much de-selfing. And I'm gonna talk about that next week. I got a session on when theology becomes pathology. And I believe that Scripture does not de-self. If anything, we are created a little lower than the angels and than the concept of the steward. We have not emphasized enough the doctrine of the creation and especially good Christian anthropology. Indeed, I am a sinner and I am fallen. And there is nothing I can do to bridge the gap or the chasm between my Creator and myself, the creature. But I am created in the image of the Creator, and I am assigned the responsibility to be a steward, not just of the earth out here, but also of myself, my psychological self. I am a steward of my own psychological health as well as I am a steward of the rest of the gifts of life. And too often I think we de-self. Part of it may come because we're afraid of being selfish. But having a good sense of self is not selfishness, because it's only those who have a good sense of self who can be then become good givers. And they do not confuse love with dependency. Dependency is enmeshment. Love is being intentional to give something to someone else out of who I am, out of my own realness, out of my own selfhood. Okay, any other questions or comments? Ken?
On the question of mothers being so important in this schema that you put up here.
Yes. Okay, very good question. What's the role of the father if you look at this theory and mother and child being the center of it all? Two things. Number one, I think what happens here is that the male must recognize he must take care of his wife's needs and deal with her feelings. He must nurture her. Because the more the husband nurtures the wife, the less the wife will need the child to nurture her. Got it? That's an important emotional system. And I would emphasize this in my preaching and my teaching, that man, when you become husband and wife becomes with child and then conceives, you now have an incredibly important task. You must nurture your wife so that she does not try to use the child to nurture her. Does that make sense? Now, if she keeps using child to nurture her, you're going to have problems. The child then is no longer going to be able to use her for its needs. The mother's using the child for her needs. Secondly, I think also the father represents separateness. He's not mother. And in that sense, represents another part of what life is all about. Now, later on in life, father may represent relationship as child gets in relationship, and mother may become the other or the separateness side. That can switch. But in the beginning, in most cultures, mother still is nurturer, but father can represent or symbolize separateness, that which is not mother. Yeah, so I'll go off to work more.
Yeah, and becomes a workaholic.
Yeah.
And begins to separate from the family. And because if I can't get the nurturing from my wife now, the wife is giving it all to the child, I'll just find some other place to
Correct. And that's why we really need to do more family life education to educate people into those kinds of things. But we're just unaware of that. What goes on and what we could be doing or sharing at this particular point. Yeah. It's almost kind of a natural triangle. That when the child comes in, now you have three people, and mother focuses on child, father feels left out, becomes angry with mother, or maybe becomes angry with child, and then he goes off to work and or gets a hobby or goes on a substance or something. Yeah. And see, the more enmeshed and the less separate these people are to begin with, the more you're going to have that kind of stuff going on. The less good sense of self people have, the more meshing and fusing you're going to have. All right, I want to talk about a couple of things. The good enough mother. This is a phrase by Donald Winnicott. We all need not a perfect mother, but a good enough mother. Now, what does a good enough mother provide? I think it's very important because I'm writing an article now called The Good Enough Pastor. And I'm going to use these very things to describe what a good enough pastor is. The good enough mother I mentioned before touches. Has to. That's how the whole sense of a self develops originally, through touch. You know, even today, if you embrace somebody, it feels so good to have a sense of the other and forget yourself, yet at the same time to be aware of yourself, to have a sense of both separateness and togetherness at one time, that hugging and touching provide. Perhaps we, out of Northern European backgrounds, have not emphasized this very sufficiently. A lot of Germans and Norwegians are afraid of touch, or at least in our homes we are not given permission to touch. I think it was Sidney Gerard who did a study of couples at lunchtime, and he observed how many times they touched each other. And I believe in Paris, France, they touched each other 100 and some times. In Rome, Italy, 150 some times. In Jacksonville, Florida, twice. In London, England, they didn't touch at all. You're just not given permission to touch. Somehow or other, you're going to have all these sexual thoughts. You know, I grew up, you couldn't dance. Because if you had, dance and you got close to somebody, you had these sexual thoughts. Strangely, I had them before we even danced. Okay, secondly is holding. In fact, to give you the name of another book, The Evolving Self, by Robert Keegan, K-E-G-A-N, Harvard University Press. He talks about human development and five different selves. But his emphasis is we are always in one holding environment, leaving it and going into another holding environment. But we always need to have some holding environment. So we always need, in some sense, a mother or a caretaker, and we'll go from one to another throughout life. I need somewhere where I'm held, that I feel like I'm integrated, that I'm all one, that I'm whole together. That's what happens also for the child. The child gets a sense of being one, of being put together, and all of the sense and different sensations are just not wild and chaotic. They're in a container, which is a self. And what's in that container, the child learns or is encouraged to learn that I can control it to some degree. I can have effect upon it. Thirdly, which I think is one of the most crucial, is the ability to do mirroring. Just think of it. Here is a small child. And this child, when you look at it, and you goo-goo and ga-ga and all that kind of stuff, extremely important because you are mirroring to the child your what? Your joy. You're mirroring to that child your hope. Now imagine you have the child in your hand. Will you stop crying, you? Ooh, why did I even have you? Now the child, the mirror is, I give displeasure. I give pain to the primary caretaker. The same in life today. We're always looking for the mirroring.
And when people give us ill mirroring, you know, we feel kind of, geez, what did I say or what did I do? When people give us positive mirroring, we feel good. And that goes back to primitive times. So we are the incredible importance to have an object that is doing positive mirroring. It is wonderful to have you in this world. Now, one more, and that is contradicting. Well, all these other things kind of seem groovy. Touching, holding, mirroring. Now, contradicting. The point here is that the child must experience optimal frustration, which means the child has to recognize that its will not always be God's will. You know, you do it your way, I'll do it God's way. But the child has to learn that there are limits to its behaviors. There are limits to what it can do and it cannot do. Very important, because if a child does not come up against an object with limitation, what happens? The child loses some self of oneself. I simply can't develop as a self in a vacuum. I need to focus over against somebody else, in tension with somebody else. So the mother has to provide optimal frustration, not too much frustration, so the child gives up in the autonomy stage, not too little frustration, so the child doesn't even get a sense of autonomy, optimal frustration. Another thing that is very, very important here for the development of self is playing. I'm going to talk about that at another time. I just don't want to talk about it now. I want to close with one statement, and that's about child abuse. Really, any kind of abuse. The child is only beginning to develop its sense of boundaries, where it begins and ends and others begin and ends. It still has a lot of undifferentiation in its life, a lot of fusion. When a client of mine describes, when she's 3 years of old, her father coming into bed and teaching her to do fellatio on him, I don't know anything about that, you see. But she describes this to me, and what it is an invasion of her boundaries. See, it's so easy to invade the boundaries of a small child, or of a child per se, because their boundaries are not yet erect. They are not firm. And the child so fantasizes the parent as being powerful that if the child even thinks what is happening is bad, what does the child do? Blames itself. A child simply cannot have a bad, imperfect, perverted parent, because the child needs the parent to be powerful, to be loving, to be approving. So what often happens to abused children, and whether the abuse is emotional, physical, verbal, or sexual, the child fantasizes, idealizes the parent as being wonderful and perfect. There is a very good book out called The Fantasy Bond by Robert Firestone, in which he describes this whole thing. That the child is such a weak, helpless, dependent creature to begin with, that when the parent is seen as imperfect, bad, or ugly, the parent has to be idealized as being wonderful and good. That's why it's so difficult for many of these individuals I work with as adults to recapture what happened as small children when they were abused. I had a 62-year-old pastor a year ago who came in and for the first time said, I now recall my 12-year-old stepbrother having anal intercourse with me. For my whole life, I have been so afraid to reveal myself because I've had to keep this secret. And he was suffering a lot of shame. I didn't want to be exposed. So now he exposed it to another person. And I want to say, it is so important that the traumas, the difficulties, the sticky parts of life, the painful parts of life become exposed, become expressed. We get sick over the things we will not talk about. families become sick over the secrets, the things they will not talk about. This girl whose father abused her at the age of 3, it happened again during her 8th year on a number of occasions. She said, "I went and told my mother, and it was like telling my mother we needed a quart of milk." My mother simply bypassed it, wouldn't look at it, wouldn't touch it. But I have to tell you very honestly that 7 out of 10 clergy wives out of 160 that I have seen have come out of abusive families. I think there's also a reason why they married clergy, but that's another issue. The incidence of abuse to me has been rather astounding. I kind of pushed it off until I began to ask male, females, children, anybody, something about their family history, where there's violation of boundaries and there is abuse. Now, you can abuse your children not only by violating their boundaries. You may also abuse your children by not taking care of your marriage. Because if the marriage is functioning, it has an effect upon the whole family. You know, the head of an elephant and the head of a chinchilla are attached to extraordinarily different bodies. But they both perform the same function, to give direction to the body. And I think it's so important as to the healthiness of the head. And mom and dad, husband and wife, are the head. When they are functioning and they are able to share feelings and meet each other's needs, there's less of a tendency then to resort to children to either scapegoat them and abuse them, or to use the child for needs. You know, it's not the method, it's not the means, the instrumentation that's important in abuse. What's important is the invasion, the violation. And I know that these people have been abused. They have boundary problems the rest of their life. I know they can learn to develop boundaries, and I've worked with people, but it takes time. But this is why this whole area of the search for the real self, that I can be in touch with my feelings and my needs, is so important. Because if I was not given permission to do that, then I don't function for me. I function for you and for you and for you and for you. And in the process, I create other kinds of problems because I have not been able to give permission to be me. Any questions or comments? We've got a couple minutes. Yes. You're scratching your head here.
Well, I'm scratching my head because I'm trying to frame my question. Seems to me, you work with pastors. It seems to me we have a large number of dysfunctional pastors who then lead a large number of dysfunctional congregations. But then we move dysfunctional pastor to dysfunctional congregation to dysfunctional congregation, and we just perpetuate the dysfunction. And I don't like the word dysfunction because it, you know, there's more or less stages of functionality, I guess, but that's the term that's used is dysfunction. That's a statement, and I don't know where to go with that as a question and put that into that object relations thing that you were talking about.
Well, I do. Let me just make one quick statement. I'm going to deal with some of that on another issue. I'm going to do a section called The Congregation as an Emotional System, and I'll address some of those issues. But see, you have also pathological congregations.
Yeah, right.
They both reinforce each other. But I believe that ministry involves very clear, good sense of boundary and self. And we do not attend to that issue.
Yeah, and if you try as a pastor to set up those boundaries and be clear, oftentimes I've seen a lot of pastors just get their heads cut off.
Yes, but I'll also address that. I have also seen a lot of pastors survive in a very healthy relationship precisely because they know how to do that in the right way. Okay. Anybody else? Any other questions or comments? Yes. Alice Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R. She has another book called For Your Own Good. which is, you know, parents saying to the children, we're only doing this for your own good. It's really for the parents' own good. Very excellent analysis of Adolf Hitler there, too, in terms of Hitler being born to, his father was illegitimate, and his father's father was a Jew. And this outrage then was taken out on the children. Hitler's father just mercilessly beat them to pulps. Now, Adolf internalized all that in his own false self, covered up his feelings and needs, and then just simply projected all that rage onto the world. Very fascinating kind of study. She does a study of a serial killer, a drug addict, and Adolf Hitler in terms of how this whole issue that we've been talking about develops. If any of you subscribe to Second Opinion from the Park Ridge Center, anybody get that? It's in the library. The newest issue, there's an interview with David Hilfiker, who is a physician, and talking about the frustration of working with this cycle of despair and poverty in Washington, D.C., with these families of very little means. See, we know that the sins of the father visit upon the children of the third and fourth generation. It just gets passed on, unless there's an intervention, because we're just unaware of what's going on. And another time I'm going to say that I think we in the church need to get out of the counseling mode and more into the intervention mode, but that's advertisement for another session. Anybody else? Time. Because I am a Texan by marriage to the woman who's sitting next to you over there. I am actually from New York. Okay. Thank you very much.
About abuse and in different forms of abuse. A person who sits at the head of the table at night gets the best piece of meat, sits at the best chair, never speaks to anyone. Very abusive, very quiet, but they say he's just a very quiet man. But the funny thing, that was my father. I married the same kind of man.
Wow, yeah. We always do to settle the issue. Yes, we always
well,
do.
I'm working my way out of that. Okay. I'm an Al-Anon member. Dealing with a lot of the things through that
on
method.
Thursday or Friday, I'm doing healthy family functioning. I'm going to talk about how we work out the family of origin issues in marriage and family.
How do you spell Margaret Mahler?
M-A-H-L-E-R.
Okay. What's the name of her book again?
The book is The Psychological Birth of the Infant.
Okay.
Now, if you wanted just a quick synopsis of that, Norma just took that little thing I had before.
Yeah. Well.
Hi.
Peterson.
Now, we're from
Hastings.
Hastings. Oh, there was a group from Hastings.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Oh, I'll be glad to. Oh.
Yeah, I might have been too, yeah. My notes and his notes both must be very valuable.
Thank you. Thank you, John. This is my wife, Kelly. I met John here.
Hi.
He's a pastor from Minnesota.
Good to see you, yeah.
What was the first book that gave those categories of development?
That's in Margaret Mahler, M-A-H-L-E-R's book, The Psychological Birth of the Child.
And it was Margaret?
Margaret.
Thanks.
Okay.
When is your next lecture?